It was with a heavy heart that I learned of the retirement of my good friend and longtime Hall of Fame broadcaster, Carl Lamb. He's been a fixture in Smithfield Selma radios for decades. At the age of 92, it was time to smell the roses. Congratulations, Mr. Carl, and may your retirement be a blessing to you and your family. Those of you who have listened to my commentaries on WTSB can still listen each Monday by email. All you have to do is send me your email address, and the commentaries will magically appear in your email, ready for listening each Monday. Send your email to me at comments@tomjoyner.net. That's comments@tomjoyner.net. If you don't send me your email, you won't be able to hear my commentaries as WTSB is going to cease to broadcast completely. So send me your email address to Tom Joyner and to comments@tomjoyner.net. comments@tomjoyner.net. The crisis on our border with Mexico was not created by Donald Trump. He inherited this fiasco because Congress failed to act to revise our immigration laws. That's Democrats and Republicans. They spend all of their time attacking one another and jockeying for political power. Our immigration laws are outdated and never were effective from the outset. Instead of acknowledging that we have a national emergency and acting quickly to revise our antiquated immigration laws, Democrats focus on keeping Trump from his promise to secure the border. It's all a political scheme for power. While Congress naively keeps its head in the sand, the poor people of Central America prove they are smarter than our lawmakers. Smugglers found that they could get rich by teaching these poor immigrants how to overcome obstacles in our immigration system to gain access here. They also instruct them on how to profit from our naivete. If you were in Guatemala in dire circumstances, why would you not head for America, where you'll be taken care of by American taxpayers? Contact your members of Congress, Democrat and Republican, and demand that Congress do its job and rewrite our immigration laws. Are Democrats right or are they wrong about a national crisis at the Mexican border? Listen and think for yourself. Last month, February, 76,000 migrant families crossed our border illegally. That broke a record for past Februaries, and it was the fourth time in 5 months that illegal migrant family migrations broke records over last year. 90% of these illegal crossings came from Guatemala. Border officials have announced that this is a full-blown crisis, yet Democrats continue to fight the president on border security. Young children are being smuggled across the border in record numbers, and it costs taxpayers some $150 per day for each one of them. The families that are apprehended at the border are allowed in, taken to court, and released into our country. They seldom, if ever, come back for their court hearings. If this does not constitute a national emergency, pray tell what does. In their zeal to deny any victories for Donald Trump, Democrats dug a hole for themselves, and they're burying us in it. They cannot now admit that we have this national emergency, because the American people would see that they had been playing politics with the border security all along. They'd rather see our ship of state sink than allow Trump to fulfill his promises to keep us safe and secure. Republican or Democrat, that should infuriate you. In my research, I found the Heritage Foundation's reports on this crisis to be on the mark. As the pileup of lawsuits proves, many believe that President Trump exceeded his authority by declaring a national emergency at the U.S.-Mexico border. They believe that because Democrats and their fake news allies told them so. The facts and the law, though, show otherwise. Trump acted only after Congress refused to fulfill its duty to protect the country and provide the resources necessary to secure the border. Anyone who believes this is not a genuine crisis is ignoring reality. It approaches what many consider an unchecked invasion. Thousands of illegal aliens, dangerous criminals, drug smugglers, and sex traffickers cross the border every day. The number of apprehensions at the border is down from a peak of more than 1 million annually. Throughout most of the 1980s, 1990s, and 2000s. But it's on the rise again. Remember, we're just talking about the illegal aliens who have been caught. That does not account for the thousands every week who escape capture. 2018 saw the largest number of apprehensions at the border since 2012. Almost 467,000. That's 467,000. According to a Pew Research Center analysis of the most recent date from U.S. Customs and Border Protection, that included 54,000 unaccompanied children and 163,000 family members, three times as many as in 2017. The sex traffickers are the modern equivalent of the horrible sea captains of the past who brought African slaves to the United States under brutal, murderous conditions that we can't even imagine today. Doctors Without Borders estimates that one of every three women, one of every three caught in these smuggling rings, are sexually assaulted before many are forced into prostitution and slavery right here. The same Mexican cartels that DHS spokesperson Katie Wallman says earned $2.5 billion annually from human smuggling are also responsible for the epidemic of drug abuse and overdoses in our country. They are bringing methamphetamine, heroin, cocaine, and fentanyl across the border, according to the Department of Homeland Security. Most drug interceptions occur at ports of entry. But, of course, that's where law enforcement is concentrated. How much more is getting through the largely unprotected, unsecured parts of the border? As for the applicable law, the president has inherent constitutional authority as the chief executive and the commander-in-chief to secure our borders. But he's specifically acted under the statutory authority of the National Emergency Act of 1976. National emergencies are not exactly an uncommon occurrence in our country. Almost 60 have been declared by prior presidents without any outcry that they were somehow acting illegally. In fact, in passing the NEA, Congress gave itself the ability to end any such declaration by passing a concurrent resolution. The National Emergency Act requires the president to cite the other federal laws under which he is acting. In his proclamation, Trump has cited a federal law on military construction funds that are part of the budget of the Department of Defense. Congress has already appropriated those funds in the amount of $3.6 billion. That statute specifically provides that the president can redirect the use of those funds when he believes it is necessary for the support of the armed forces. And the president is given broad discretion to make that determination. Here, he has determined that the armed forces are being required to assist the Department of Homeland Security, and those funds are necessary to build the barriers that will secure the border. Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Hussein Obama also directed the military to assist the Border Patrol during their administrations. According to the White House, they both used this same military construction fund 18 different times for projects from 2001 to 2014. None of the states and politicians complaining about Trump ever complained before about this. Moreover, the White House has identified $601 million from the Treasury Department's forfeiture fund that it intends to use for border security. Those funds are supposed to be used to help law enforcement. Nobody can credibly argue that using these funds to help secure the border is not assisting law enforcement. There is also another $2.5 billion in Defense Department funds that, pursuant to another federal statute, can specifically be used for counter-drug activities. Again, no one can rationally argue that securing the border is not a counter-drug activity. Congress should have acted, but they didn't. It gave the president only enough money in the latest government funding bill to erect 55 miles of fencing, with many restrictions along a border that is 2,000 miles long and completely open in many areas. The president's actions in reaction to that and to the crisis at the border are certainly not the ideal way this should be dealt with in our constitutional republic, but they are fully within his constitutional authority and the statutory authority provided to him by Congress. The annual Oscar Awards in February 2019 saw the predictable outrage from Hollywood liberals, black and white. From an opening shot at President Trump about the wall on the southern border, to Spike Lee's openly hostile appeal to defeat Trump in the 2020 election. Spike Lee is a spiteful little man for whom a full eclipse would not be black enough. None of that belonged in a nationally televised program to honor movies and the neurotic people who act in them. Why someone who needs the support of ticket buyers would want to alienate half of the population is a mystery. Nevertheless, it spurred me to reflect on the myth about black America wanting a frank discussion of racism. First of all, this growing hate for all white men is unwarranted. This station, or rather nation, came into being when patriots in the 13 colonies rebelled against British rule. That brought on the Revolutionary War, which was waged by an overwhelmingly large number of white men. Only about 1,000 blacks actually fought in that war. There would be no United States of America without the white men who stood up to King George. As I was researching this commentary, I found help from John McWhorter of City Magazine and Dana White, a black writer for Capitalism Magazine. They spoke on what's holding America back and why blacks remain oppressed, but not by white Americans. Anytime anyone exposes the hypocrisy of self-appointed leaders of the black community who mouth the ideology of victimhood for political and monetary advantage, you're automatically labeled a racist. That's designed to shut down dialogue on the issue. Let's start with the fact that slavery and racism was a blight on America. But not just America. Slavery existed centuries before the United States came into existence. Slavery was an accepted part of life in Mother Africa, dating back before Christ. It stands to reason that ancestors of African Americans in the United States had a hand in slavery. Critics of America see profit and benefits in a racism forever movement. Their conviction rests on seven Articles of Faith, carefully passed from person to person at all levels of the black community. The first of those is that most black people are poor. Almost half of all black people surveyed in a Gallup poll supposed that 3 out of 4 black people live in inner cities. Yet statistics from 2001 show that most black people are neither poor nor even close to it. By any estimation, middle-class blacks outnumber poor ones. And at last count, only 1 in 5 blacks lived in inner cities. Second is the myth that black people earn 61% of what whites do. Though accurate as a nationwide median in 1995, this figure is dragged down by the disproportionate number of single black welfare mothers. Black two-parent families earned 87% of what two-parent white families earned at that time. Also distorting the median is the disproportionate number of blacks who live in the South, where wages are lower overall. If we look at specific areas, rather than the nation as a whole, black household earnings as far back as 1994 exceeded whites in 130 cities and counties across the nation. In the 1990s, there was the myth of an epidemic of racist church burnings that had swept across the South. There was never any such thing. Between 1990 and 1996, about 80 black churches were burned. But then, over 7 times that many white churches were burned as well. Then there was the lie that the CIA created the inner cities by pumping drugs into them. This one pops up in pamphlet after pamphlet at leftist marches and gatherings, and it's taught to many college snowflakes who know no better. It started with a leftist newspaper, the San Jose Mercury's charges, but was found to be false. Then there's myth number 5. That one says that black men are disproportionately incarcerated. Racism reigns eternal. This belief assumes that blacks do not commit crimes any more frequently than whites. But surveys in the 1990s showed that 50% of the prison population was black, and they committed 42% of violent crimes in the 1990s. And many studies have shown that when severity of crime and past records are taken into account, there is no basis for claiming that there is a bias against blacks in the criminal justice system. At its inception, the war on drugs, often interpreted as a war on blacks, had the strong support of the Congressional Black Caucus, whose members aimed to stem inner-city violence. If these black officials, who at the time exhorted Congress to save our communities, were racists, then the definition of that term is beyond comprehension. The sixth myth is that racial profiling is racism. Of course, it could be, but more often it is not. In some parts of the country, black men are so overrepresented in criminal activities that police officers, white and black, would be shirking their duty not to concentrate on them. Halting profiling means that there would be an increase in the number of blacks murdered, mostly by other blacks. Self-appointed black leaders like Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, and Louis Farrakhan can cite this rise as further evidence of racism, as happened in New York in the 1980s when cops turned a blind eye to a wave of black crime. These articles of faith add up to a deeply felt cult of victimology that grips the entire black community. Some subscribe to it fiercely. Most accept it as a valid point of view, at least. The serious brother, who launches a tirade about a war on blacks at a party, sets heads nodding all over the room. You'd think that a group committed to advancement would avoid such an obsessive focus on the negative, especially when that negative steadily fades from year to year. In the grip of this seductive ideology, blacks have made the immobilizing assumption that individual initiative can lead only to failure, only with a few exceptionally gifted or lucky exceptions. Yet many groups of people have triumphed over similar or worse obstacles, including millions of Caribbean and African immigrants in America, from Colin Powell to the thousands of Caribbean children succeeding in the same crumbling schools where black kids are failing. Indeed, black thinkers such as Thomas Sowell argue that black Americans could have advanced and were advancing even without civil rights legislation of the 60s and the racial preferences of the 70s, since black unemployment was at an all-time low in the mid-60s, and the black middle class was already growing fast. But blacks aren't the only people who've sabotaged themselves through victimology. Take the eerily similar case of the Boston Irish, the target of contempt and discrimination in 19th century America. By the 1920s, when anti-Irish bigotry had receded greatly, historical memory allowed Mayor James Michael Curley to maintain power by stoking Irish resentment, very much like today's black resentment. Curley found anti-Irish, Anglo-Saxon culture was fatally diseased. Even today, the remnant of this mentality still traps members of South Boston's Irish community in crummy housing projects, idle adults who have high rates of substance abuse, and even speak a local dialect. It takes a while to understand that dialect. In South Boston, as in South Central L.A., a fatalistic skepticism that you can rise above your community in a deeply embedded wariness of mainstream culture thwart ambition, even where opportunity is available. The victimology cult has in turn engendered a cult of black separatism, inspired by the black power movement of the 1960s, which violently rejected whites as terminally ill. Today's separatism, in the same vein, flirts disastrously with the idea that because white racism drives black people outside the bounds of civic virtue, blacks shouldn't seriously be punished or morally condemned for their criminal behavior. A typical consequence of this view was the celebrating of four black youths who maimed several people in Los Angeles after the Rodney King verdict, when Farrakhan's Nation of Islam set up a defense fund for the so-called L.A. Four, or Jesse Jackson's intervention when a Decatur, Illinois high school suspended for 2 years seven black teenagers who injured bystanders during a gang fight at a high school football game. Jackson tried to paint that response to thuggery as a racist attempt to deny our children an education. The worst result of the sense that black America is fundamentally separate realms is the widespread cult of anti-intellectualism. Consider the data. Even in middle-class suburbs, increasing numbers of middle-class black students tend to cluster at the bottom of their schools in grades and test scores. A survey in the late 1990s revealed that black students, whose parents earned $70,000 a year or more, made median SAT scores lower than impoverished white students, whose parents made $6,000 a year or less, while black students, whose parents both had graduate degrees, made mean SAT scores lower than white students whose parents only completed high school. So why? All through modern black American culture, even throughout black academia, the belief prevails that learning for learning's sake is a white affair and therefore inherently disloyal to a proper black identity. It's called acting white. Studying black-related issues is okay because learning about yourself is authentic. But this impulse also implicitly classifies science as irrelevant, which is the direct cause of the underrepresentation of minorities in the hard sciences. The sense that the proper black person only delves into topics related to themselves is also why you can count on one hand the number of books by black Americans that are not on racial topics. The belief that blacks and schools don't go together gained strength in the mid-1960s, when black separatism rejected traits associated with whites as alien, and black students, in that spirit, began teasing their fellow students who strove to excel in school as acting white, a much harsher taunt than merely dismissing them as nerds. The acting white charge, which implies that you think yourself different from and better than your peers, is the prime reason that blacks do poorly in school. The gifted black student quickly faces a choice between peer group acceptance and intellectual achievement. Most, out of an utterly human impulse, choose the former. The fact that the children of working black immigrants, including black Caribbean and African immigrants, often do well in school disproves the claim that their working class roots deny the newly middle class blacks the cultural capital to teach their children to excel in schools. The success of Southeast Asian immigrant children in the same terrible inner city schools in which black students fail disproves the Jonathan Kozol gospel that it is the savage inequality of school funding that makes black kids fail. It's time for our selective educational institutions to eliminate affirmative action in admissions. The policy may have been useful in the 1960s in creating the black middle class. The tacit understanding is that white students somehow ought not suspect that black students got in only by affirmative action. But this is a hopelessly unrealistic fiction, given that in 28 selective schools, less than 1 in 4 white students with SAT scores in the 1250 to 1299 bracket was admitted, while 3 out of 4 black students with the same scores got in. Almost 50 years after the Civil Rights Act was proposed in Congress, liberals continue to insist that blacks are incapable of meeting the same standards as whites. It is conservatives who believe in the limitless potential of blacks. We have seen black CEOs at American Express, AOL Time Warner, Merrill Lynch, and others. Oprah Winfrey is a multi-billionaire, and Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice have been secretaries of state. Too many blacks do remain oppressed, but not by whites. Rather, it is by blacks who relish a perverse subculture of low standards and perpetual victimization. No longer do white racists tell black children that books are only for white people. Today, black people do it. Every day, black children suffer ridicule and disgrace for doing their homework, behaving in class, striving for excellence, in short, for acting white. Within the perimeters of the black subculture, success is exalted only when it's earned in sports or music or dance and in the Democrat Party. Should a black person succeed in other arenas, for example, becoming Secretary of State, Supreme Court Justice, or National Security Advisor, he or she is exiled from the race. His or her racial identity is revoked. Within this subculture, blacks have narrowly defined the path to success to equate black with victim. Condoleezza Rice? Well, she wasn't a victim, so ergo, she's not really black. Bill Clinton played the victim, and he was declared the first black president. For those who keep saying, we need to talk about race in America, we just did. Not a single word that you just heard is meant to hurt black people. On the contrary, they're meant to point out that black Americans have far more to fear from other black Americans than they do from whites. Until black America puts aside victimhood and sheds themselves of self-appointed leaders whose very likelihood depends upon keeping blacks and whites at each other's throats, the black community will continue to forego progress. The past is in the past. What happened to any of our ancestors 150 years ago has no bearing on our ability to educate ourselves and realize our full potential today. We don't need to keep having a dialogue on race. It has been beat to death. What we need is a focus on the future and less emphasis on race.